Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books and Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. And today we have such a special opportunity for a joint point podcast today between myself and Emily Crandall. Emily, are you there?
I am.
Emily, you're going to tell us about the podcast that you do. We're going to share this podcast and share it with Cyril Ghosh, who is not just the author of the book we're going to be talking about, but is also the original host of the New Books in Political Science podcast. So, Cyril, are you there as well?
Yes, I am, Heath.
Wonderful. So welcome back to your podcast. This is yours that we've simply been borrowing over the last couple of years. Emily, would you like to start us off just a little bit and tell us about the other podcast this is going to be on and you know, about yourself as well?
Great. So this episode of New Books in Political Science is also a collaboration with the New Books in Global Ethics and Politics channel, which is produced out of the Center for Global Ethics and Politics in the Ralph Bunche Institute at the CUNY Graduate Center.
Wonderful.
Of which I am a host and
you're
a fellow,
a recent graduate. Congratulations on defending your dissertation.
Thank
this
you.
Is. Yes, congratulations on that,
yeah,
Emily.
For everyone who said that hosting a podcast would get in the way of all our productivity, this is proof that that is not the case. This, in fact, has helped you move on towards your completion.
Indeed.
Cyril, you have been on before, not just as a host, but also as a guest talking about your research. Maybe we can just get an update on where you are, and then we'll talk about your book. So, Cyril, tell us, just remind us who you are.
Actually, let me first say thank you to both of you. This is great that you're doing this. And I remember doing this myself several years ago, and I had a great time and then just, you know, couldn't do it for much longer because life, you know, happened. But I'm so happy to see that it's thriving and the two of you are doing this, and I'm grateful and I'm just very happy to be here today talking to you both.
Yeah.
In terms of where I am, the first interview I did with you was for my book on the American Dream. It's called The Politics of the American Dream. It's a long subtitle. This was a few years ago now. And since then, I have had the good fortune, the circumstances, and the context to just develop my research in two other areas. One of them is sort of public law and sexuality, and the other is citizenship and immigration. And so today we are talking about this book that's come out, the book called Demoralizing Gay Rights. But fortunately, I've also just finished writing a book on citizenship with Elizabeth Cohen up in Syracuse in the political science department, who's a colleague and former dissertation advisor and a friend and co-author now. I wrote that book with her. And funnily, I'm actually doing another interview on New Books in Political Science on that book, which it's coming out later this month in the U.S., and that's scheduled for soon, like in a couple weeks or so. So I'm doing all sorts of things. Yeah.
Yeah, Cyril, the full title of the book, which is important, is Demoralizing Gay Rights: Some Queer Remarks on LGBT Rights Politics in the United States. There's a lot to talk about the book. We're talking about this. I think this is also the first podcast to be recorded in three different New York City boroughs. I'm in New York. Cyril, you're in Staten Island. Emily, you are in Manhattan. Because you're in Manhattan, and we always defer to Manhattan, maybe you could start our conversation a little bit. And so would you like to get started?
I would love to. Oh, I was just hoping to hear, Cyril, you talk a little bit about sort of the motivation for the project, kind of why you wrote the book. We were chatting a bit in the preparation and the lead up, and you mentioned that some of the comments you make in your conclusion aren't quite why you wrote it, but rather the experience of sort of dealing with the project as part of your life and that process. And I thought that conclusion was really important and very, it gives a lot of interesting context to the sort of wide range of kind of cases that you tackle here. So could you say a little bit about the sort of motivation and why you came to this and all that stuff?
Sure, Emily, and thanks for that. I mean, it was hard for me to write that epilogue. I had to say a few things about why I take the positions I do. In fact, it's about positionality. And that's cathartic, it's introspective, it's in part like memoir, it's confessions, it's a lot of things that one has to think through and disclose about oneself. And it's not easy for everyone. Certainly it isn't for me. But there's two things. One is how I came to write this book, and the other is how I experienced the writing of the book. And it's the latter that I talk about mostly in the epilogue. And your question is about that, so I'll try to respond to that. But I have to say a few things about how I got to write the book in the first place. It was actually, strangely enough, Heath Brown is himself responsible for this book and its writing. And I'll explain how. A few years ago, Heath was involved with the New York State Political Science Association, and he invited me to join the executive board as the section chair of identity politics for that political science association. And since then, I've had the opportunity to serve like a couple times as program chair, as section chair of identity politics, and I'm vice president of the NYSPSA next year. And I've gotten quite involved in it. And at one of these conferences, Michelle Chen, who's the acquisitions editor at Palgrave Pivot, she approached some of us and asked us if we had any sort of book projects in mind. And at the time, I didn't actually have a book project in mind on this subject. I was working on the citizenship book that I just mentioned. And I had written like a standalone piece on, which is a critique of the Obergefell versus Hodges decision, and I write about that in this book. That piece came out in Polity a year ago, I want to say, and I had only written that. But since Michelle brought it up and I started thinking about it, and I was like, you know, I've been bothered by a few things within this sub-discipline, as it were. And I started to put together my thoughts, and I'm like, well, maybe there's a book project. And I fell into it by accident in a sense. And I wanted to write something that was critically appreciative of Kenji Yoshino's work on covering. And in my teaching and my research, I've been thinking about this, the question of pinkwashing, which we'll talk about in a little bit, I hope. And these three things together, I was like, yes, there is a book right here. And then it sort of became a book. But now to respond more directly to your question, I mean, while I was writing it, I was trying to understand what it is that sort of, you know, that motivates me to write these kinds of things, these specific types of critiques and polemics. And I realized that I'm pretty routinely and frequently frustrated with people around me, both in a professional setting, both in professional settings and in sort of personal settings, trying to ascribe to me not just labels, but also like, you know, recommending, prescribing ways to be in both explicitly and less explicitly, more subtly, making clear that they have a certain set of expectations about my demeanor, my attitude, my political values and philosophy and all the rest of it. And it turns out that I routinely find myself, you know, dissatisfying people because I can't live up to whatever it is that they expect me to be. And this is where I realize that there are various axes of identity along which this happens. So being South Asian, being immigrant, being queer identified, being left identified, all of these things, it makes people wonder if I should be a certain type of person. And I'm constantly told that I'm like a race betrayer, like a sexuality betrayer, like a political ideology betrayer. And I just can't live up to people's expectations of what it actually means or how I should be as a queer identified South Asian immigrant academic who's left of center. And those continuous frustrations makes me feel like, okay, I want to say that, you know, people are complicated. People have nuanced views on stuff. I mean, I can't be as left of center as my lefty friends want me to be. And I can't be as conservative, politically conservative, as my sort of centrist friends want me to be. And that's just one of these things, right? And there's other things like, you know, my gender performance. I mean, it's not quite clear exactly what I should be doing to be found to be acceptable both by straights and gays or queers or whatever. So, and that's what I write about in the epilogue, that I just can't fit in, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah, it's a really powerful way to introduce the book, that's broken up into really three different essays. And as you allude to, I wanted to start talking about the first of these. Though when I read the chapter, I kept thinking about this conversation. I knew, so I'm not going to make this mistake. I knew I was going to make the mistake and call it the radical creep theory, and that's not what you described. You did not describe the radical creep theory. I know that's a book that you will write in the future, but instead you describe radical theory creep, which makes so much more sense. And is one of the ways that you think about this phenomena of pinkwashing. So I wonder if you can talk about first pinkwashing for those that don't know the term, and also this idea of radical theory creep.
I'll try to talk about pinkwashing first and then address the question of RTC, the radical theory creep phrasing. So pinkwashing actually is a term that was used in the beginning as a critique of the hyper-commercialization of a specific type of breast cancer awareness and breast cancer research. And one of the things that that the critics said was that whenever corporations try to sell something and say, well, okay, if you buy this, part of the proceeds are going to go to breast cancer awareness or breast cancer research, that's a way of commodifying this virtue and you shouldn't be doing this. And then the term then gets adopted and one might even say co-opted and used in this specific context of gay rights rhetoric and gay rights discourse. And the people who popularize it are Sarah Schulman and Catherine Franke. In the beginning, this was around 2011, 2012, when they first started talking about it in these terms. And the concept is actually, it means the following thing. Some countries, and it's actually some institutions, but mostly it is countries or institutions within countries, rhetorically posit their sort of pro-gay rights attitudes as one way to demonstrate to the rest of the world that they are on the, you know, one way of saying this is on the right side of history. And in so doing, they sort of they juxtapose themselves with countries or other institutions that do not share their pro-gay rights agenda or attitude. And in so doing, these countries vilify or demonize those countries as sort of retrogressive, backward, uncivilized, and so on and so forth. So when one brandishes or advertises one's own pro-gay rights agenda as a way to cast aspersions on other countries which don't have progressive gay rights, that specific act of branding oneself as better and then vilifying the others on the basis of the fact that those people are not in favor of gay rights, that specific act has been called pinkwashing. Now, many countries have been accused of doing this. It's not just countries, actually. But the paradigmatic case, the canonical case, is that of the State of Israel, which has actively sought to brand itself as a pro-gay rights place. And in so doing, they have, you know, they've recruited brand experts like, you know, advertising agencies like Saatchi & Saatchi and so on. And so that scholars and activists and lots of people on the political left have critiqued the State of Israel for doing this and pointed out that, among other people, Netanyahu, will use any opportunity to show that because Israel is so progressive on gay rights, that anyone around the State of Israel, geographically around the State of Israel, typically Arab countries, who do not have these progressive stances on gay rights are somehow uncivilized, backward, unenlightened, benighted, etc. And so, so this is the concept of pinkwashing. And the U.S. has done it. The European Union has done it, as I talk about at some length. They have positioned themselves as the progressive people, and in so doing, they have positioned themselves in contradistinction to other countries which don't have progressive gay rights. Now, when I read the literature on pinkwashing, though, it appears to me that something happens in those critiques, that some of those critiques turn out to be better than others. And the less good ones engage in what I call radical theory creep. It happens not simply in the pinkwashing literature, it happens everywhere, actually. Just to elaborate on the concept is this, that, you know, sometimes some forms of theory, they start off as quite pointed and analytically rigorous, and they give themselves the task of critiquing one specific thing. But soon there is the experience, a version of what, mission creep. As in, they expand their ambit and progressively become somewhat more totalizing. And that in and of itself would not be terrible, but some instances of this kind of totalizing move ends up harming the theory itself. And in so doing, they often hurt the more analytically rigorous versions of it, because they sort of, they lend themselves to criticism by others who are like, well, what are you doing? Your theory is not so sophisticated, in part because it is totalizing. And it happens in quite a few domains, and pinkwashing is just one of them.
You have this great quote, before we move on, related to this, where you write in sort of describing one of these types of critiques, says, you write, where is this, on page 18, but this is not an ism, this is a shopping cart. What's the problem with the shopping cart?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Let's see. A shopping cart is obviously a metaphor. And it's many different things, like disparate things, and they don't necessarily cohere. And I think that is the problem. The section you're referring to, it actually comes in my discussion of various pieces by Jasbir Puar, who has done excellent work, actually, in various places. Even with pinkwashing, she has some excellent critiques. But she slips into a somewhat totalizing critique of pinkwashing, in where she sort of, in my estimation, loses track of the fact that pinkwashing is not only about the state of Israel. Pinkwashing is a larger phenomenon, and she insists that it's necessarily Islamophobic in various places she does. And as I show, there are instances of pinkwashing where it's not Islamophobic. It is still pinkwashing. It's just not Islamophobic. That doesn't mean there is no Islamophobic pinkwashing. There is, but you know, not every instance of pinkwashing is Islamophobic. So, and one of the things, and there's a little quote above it. Let me see if I can find it. She talks about pinkwashing as one manifestation and practice made possible within and because of homo nationalism. Unlike pinkwashing, homonationalism is not a state practice per se. It is instead the historical convergence of state practices, transnational circuits of queer commodity culture and human rights paradigms, and broader global phenomena, such as the increasing entrenchment of Islamophobia. And she goes on about, you know, the discursive and structure circuits produced by the U.S. and European crusades against the spectral threat of radical Islam or Islamofascism. Now, I think that there is something to be said about these things, each one of these things, but melding them together this way sort of loses its analytical sort of focus and rigor. And I try to point that out. I'm not opposed to shopping carts, but you know, an ism needs a little more coherence about how things are connected to each other.
I think that this chapter is such a good example of the kind of sort of problem of the positive project of radicalism. And I loved how you were talking at the beginning about the idea that, right, people are complicated. And I think you make the argument in this chapter really convincingly that also arguments should remain complicated, or we should let critique be complicated, and that there's this kind of urge or impulse to link all the injustices together, perhaps analytically correctly so, but in this conceptual way, what ends up happening is that they all lose their force of analysis. And so there's this like slippage between the analytic force of the claim and the declarative force of it. And I love how you sort of parse that out in this chapter. That's not a question. That was just a way of reframing it.
Thank you. Actually, Sarah Ahmed has a great, great piece on problematic proximities, where she It's really fascinating because I think the stickiness of words, like when words are positioned next to each other, she's completely correct about that. I think that they start to acquire associations and family resemblances even when, you know, and none may exist in the beginning. And as a result, excuse me, and I think a version of this is going on. If all pink washing is always already associated with Islamofascism or Islamophobia, then we forget that countries that are, you know, we forget about instances of pink washing when Islam is actually not part of the discourse. Like, it's actually something else. So,
well, and as you mentioned, it gives you pause when you're maybe trying to engage the project of like what gay rights looks like or what it could look like or should look like. Do we want to keep going on pink washing? Do we want to move into...
I think moving on. Why don't we move on to the next chapter?
Well, maybe, Cyril, do you want to just quickly walk us through the argument on the third chapter, and then we can sort of... I'm really interested in actually how you see these two chapters as related to one another, because I had a couple thoughts about that, but I'd love to hear you talk about, maybe just introduce the argument in the chapter and then say a little bit about how they build on one another.
You mean the chapter on radical theory creep and the chapter on marriage equality? Right. So actually, in some ways of thinking, I'm upset, obviously, in each of these two chapters. But in the first chapter, I'm upset with the radicals, right, or the self-proclaimed radicals. And in the next chapter, the one in which I critique the Supreme Court decision in Obergefell versus Hodges, I'm upset with the assimilationists. I'm upset with the normals. I use this word self-consciously. I'm deliberately using this word. I'm not happy with the normals and the power they enact over the queers. And I am upset that the United States Supreme Court issues an opinion that is so sweeping and so completely oblivious to ways of family formations that don't fit the traditional mold. And I'm upset that the United States Supreme Court feels like centering this kind of idea of a dyadic romantic love and the idea of procreation or adoption, but in any case, child rearing, as sort of somehow central to the discussion on marriage equality. And I think that it's an injustice to all sorts of people who either cannot or will not form traditional families, and it's oppressive, I think, and it is directly against a sort of a philosophically liberal commitment to neutrality. It is an obvious endorsement of a very specific conception of the good, and I just don't see why we shouldn't critique it, why we shouldn't say that, well, we object. This is not what the state should be doing, like positioning one ideal form of family formation upon which the court then grounds grounds marriage equality in the across the 50 states.
You have a suggestion for how the court could have ruled differently with a similar outcome, but less sweeping in its sort of social effect. Would you describe a little bit about that? How the court could have ruled in this case differently?
It could have actually done a number of different things, like a number of different types of legal reasoning could have been used to issue that opinion, and at least in my estimation. But they all can be lumped together under the umbrella of the following phrase. The phrase is not mine. It's from Cass Sunstein's pretty solid work on this subject. And the phrase is decisional minimalism. And I'm grateful to Professor Keith Bybee at Syracuse University for first introducing me to the concept. And we wrote something several years ago in which we used this idea. And it's very simple. The concept is that, you know, when the Supreme Court issues an opinion on a polarizing dispute like this, it typically tries to issue a minimalist decision that is not sweeping, that is very narrow in its application, and it deals with one case at a time. And sometimes it comes up with, you know, fully worked out legal reasoning. Sometimes it cannot. But what it wants to do is just adjudicate that specific polarizing dispute. And in so doing, it often tries to do this. It tries to make it so that the victorious party does not feel like it has won everything. And it tries to make the losing litigants feel like they didn't lose everything. And in so doing, the result of that is that it's sort of, you know, the court comes across as not necessarily partisan. It sort of tempers the conflict. It does all sorts of good things when the court is not issuing sweeping opinions and instead adjudicates one case narrowly, minimally at a time. So in the case of Obergefell, for example, a number of types of legal reasoning could have been used. Like, the court could have ruled narrowly on the question of equal protection under the 14th Amendment. It could have used just simply the due process clause of the 14th Amendment to strike down as unconstitutional any state bans on same-sex marriage. It could have done. It could have found, as it did in other cases on gay rights in Romer, for example, it could have found like a clear case of animus against one party. Like it could have found various types of justifications for offering the legal reasoning to issue this judgment. I have nothing against the judgment, but it's the legal reasoning that sort of entwines the equal protection and due process clauses of the 14th Amendment to discover the right to equal dignity, which is a completely new right and not anywhere written in the Constitution. That, I think, is a bit, misguided.
Well, I was sort of interested in this discussion you have about how the judgment, and this actually comes up in the chapter on pinkwashing as well, this idea that these words sort of do things kind of outside of the intention of the people who argue them or critique them. And I was curious about how, I know you said one of the differences or sort of links between these chapters is you're in one sense arguing with radicals on one hand and arguing with the normals on the other, but how else are these chapters sort of speaking to one another in the sense of tacking between critique or sorry about that noise or I lost my train of thought.
You were it sounds to me, Emily, like you have an interconnection that you found between the two chapters, which maybe it does not occur to me. So if that is the case, will you speak a little bit about that, because I'm really intrigued now.
Well, I think it's really fascinating that in the first chapter, one of the issues is that critique has a kind of assimilationist force to it, even when it's anti-assimilation. To me, seems to be kind of one of the central arguments of both chapters, but they work in two different directions. And I think that's kind of really interesting. And it speaks about the sort of, at the same time, the elasticity of assimilation, but also its kind of rigidity or its even its emptiness in a way. And I think that's just a really fascinating connection. Yeah.
Well, it's actually shaming. Actually, it's shaming. It's the thing that is going on, and actually not just these two cases, but also in the Yoshino stuff uncovering. There is a lot of shaming going on that is sort of exercised on the backs of a binary logic that is always already either implicit or explicit. And the binary logic is that if you agree with us, then you're enlightened. If you don't, somehow you are benighted and you're on the wrong side of history. So this is going on both in the Supreme Court, which actually, like, you know, goes to melodramatic lengths to valorize romantic love, fidelity, monogamy, parenting, and all the rest of it. And in so doing, it kind of sort of implicitly shames people for not being, either not wanting to or not being able to form those types of intimacies and relationships. And a version of this kind of shaming is going on in the among the radicals too, in the case of pinkwashing. Like, if you don't agree with them that all pinkwashing is necessarily, like, you know, about US imperialism and Islamophobia somehow, and you want to take a step back and you say, well, you know what, I don't think you should be shaming me for having a viewpoint that is different from yours. I mean, dissent is not something we should be ashamed of. We have good reasons for it. We should be allowed to articulate them without being sort of, you know, vulnerable to the charge of, like, somehow, like, you know, really bad politics, you know. So that's one thing that is common to all three chapters, actually. I'm really upset with the sanctimonious tone of these articulations. And it's funny because I was recently giving a talk at the University of Ottawa on the Obergefell chapter. And somebody there, whose name I won't mention right this second, told me that, yes, you seem to be so upset about how sanctimonious these other people are, but you are yourself quite sanctimonious. And I'm like, you are 100% right. I mean, I could not actually be any more sanctimonious than this book. Like, it is actually it's quite sanctimonious, my critique of other people's, whatever the noun is, sanctimoniousness or sanctimony or
sanctimony. Well, you do offer it in the spirit of polemicy, if we can say that. So I think that sort of, you know, lightens the sanctimonious tone a little bit.
Yeah, we're kind of reaching the end now. I'm sure that I am going to be placed on the wrong side of history for bringing this great conversation to its close. The book title is, again, Demoralizing Gay Rights, Some Queer Remarks on LGBT Rights, Politics in the United States. Cyril Ghosh is the author. Palgrave is the publisher. We've been doing this as a partnership between the New Books in Political Science podcast and, Emily,
the New Books in Global Ethics and Politics podcast.
And also have had such a pleasure to have Cyril Ghosh on the call today talking about the book. Cyril, thank you very much.
No, thank you, Emily and Heath, both of you, very, very much. I mean, this is a wonderful opportunity for me, and I'm looking forward to, you know, seeing the two of you at some point soon.
Definitely. And as you can tell, there's much to discuss in the book. So yeah, it's worth
meet in the Bronx.
Read for the listeners out there.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right.